This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rustan, today we have a rare appearance on A Bit of Culture, BFM's very own Ezra Zayed.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
And we have the return of, once upon a time, BFM's very own, now no longer, Lee Chui Lin.
Thank you. Here from the wilderness.
An alumni.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Just, we found her sobbing outside and said, come on in.
Waiting for a delicious conversation.
Yeah. So this week, our three topics will be, topic number one is kids these days. Topic number two is wokeness. And finally, topic number three, the football manager, or the role of the manager in football.
There you go.
Yeah. So with topic number one, I'm not afraid to say that I have become obsessed with 17-year-olds recently.
Oh, dear. There's a great setup to any conversation.
Strong opening.
Right. But I don't get to hang out with 17-year-olds as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. This has come about because over a week ago, there was a shooting in Florida, in America. And it was just another shooting. Lots of people died. It was just same old, same old. But then a strange thing happened. The children themselves, the survivors, turned out to be this incredibly eloquent, thoughtful, mature,
fiery,
organized bunch of kids. They've been this sort of galvanizing force. And I was watching them, I was so impressed by their power. But it reminded me, though, something I read about here in Malaya. Back in 1957, I was reading an old copy of the Straits Times in the lead up to Merdeka. And I was expecting to be reading about, you know, the excitement of Merdeka. Instead, I was reading about this unfolding story about this protest movement that was happening in Chinese language schools. And I think I was a bit unclear about exactly what they were protesting about. But I think that these children were very scared that Chinese language education was going to be stopped. So it's up in the north, I think, in Penang, Ipoh.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And they were these kids were taking over their schools and barricading themselves into their classrooms. And the police, who were run by Orang Putih back then, would shout in and say, send us out your leaders so that we can negotiate.
That sounds like a very British thing to do.
Sounds like a great movie is what it sounds like. I'd watch that.
But the kids shouted back, we are all leaders here.
Wow.
And then there's this photograph of this young, small, tiny schoolgirl in her pinafore. And she's pushed this British chief of police in his big khaki shorts, and the photograph captures him at the moment where he's falling over.
Wow.
And the look on his face is like, what the hell just happened? And this little girl has just pushed him. I read these stories. I was thinking, who are these people? Whatever happened to them?
But aren't we all like that?
Are we?
I think.
Were you?
I think you're definitely that way when you have less to lose and when you have your whole life ahead of you to gain. It's the cusp of when everything's going to happen for you, right? Like, if you look at, oh no, I'm forgetting her name, Emma...
Gonzalez,
thank you. The 17-year-old, the senior, who's been, you know, that snippet of her speech has been shared far and wide. Mm. She's been front and center in the town halls. And I look at her and I think, well, yes, at 17 and 18, I think that's when people are most afraid of you. Because that it's before you start getting weighed down by the banalities of adulthood, you know, it's before you start getting all these things to lose, where people can take things away from you, where you can lose your livelihood, where you can lose all these different things if you're radical or if you are out there, so to speak. And yet it's also that period of time where you're feeling the most. And I just look at it and I think, it's not that I don't admire them, I really do, but I also think this is just the perfect time for them to be speaking this way.
But speaking of timing, I also find it so fascinating that, you know, with regards to Florida and the kids coming out in this particular moment, America's gone through in the past few years a number of high school type shootings. And I guess for all of these kids in Florida to be organized, actually all across the country, it's created this ripple effect, right? Marches right across different cities. Why is it this moment and not what happened at Sandy Hook? And why is it this moment that people have said this is enough? And even going back to your story, Cam, about what happened in Malaya with regards to these kids and the Chinese language, it must have been almost this tipping point saying, well, if we lose this, then what is it worth?
I've actually been thinking about this a lot because in the wake of the shooting, I think we saw a lot of Americans posting little snippets of experiences of speaking to their kids and the kinds of heartbreaking conversations they've had to have about, well, do you know what to do? What is the protocol in your school? What is the active shooter protocol? What is going to happen? I think that as someone who grew up in Malaysia, finished almost all of my schooling here, this is so foreign to me. The notion that you have to run through drills. I mean, fire drills here are just the height of inefficiency in and of itself. People just go like, eh, it's a drill. And, you know, and the notion that there are schools where you're taught, okay, the black paper is going to go down, the table is going to go against the door. I was seeing someone talk about how a doorstop can be a life-saving thing because you just put it on the other side of the door and then someone can't get in. And these are the kinds of thoughts that we will never have to have. And yet, these are the kinds of thoughts that for some of these kids have informed their entire schooling experience, right? They've had to do this for 4 years, 6 years, however long they've been in school.
Well, I know older, much older Americans who went to school in the 1950s, and they remember how they were given drills on what to do in the event of a nuclear attack.
Mm.
And it stayed with them. It's still a sort of like a central moment in their lives, in their memory, was the fear that they had growing up.
Which actually translates to the fear of, you know, any traveler going to a particular busy tourist site, right? You have this moment where hopefully nothing's going to happen on this day at this particular site, right? Because it could be anywhere. Berlin, Florida, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta. Yeah, it could be anywhere. And it feels that that is the environment that we're all growing up in now.
But let's just get back to, before we move on, the original premises, were that young people.
Yes.
So
you're impressed by them?
I am. And I really hope that I was never called upon when I was 17, 18 to do anything in particular. So I don't know if I could have done it. But I know I couldn't have done it. I hope that in Malaysia, children can. But I just want to finish with one thing. One thing that these children have in common in that one particular school is that they are pretty much all members of the drama club.
Oh.
Yeah, they were all in plays where they're quoting lines written by, I don't know, Arthur Miller. And they're also having to do improv.
They're comfortable with public speaking.
And every night is fear night when you have that going on stage. It's, you know, kids.
Well, there's also been those accusations that they're crisis actors. Is that what they're calling it?
Well, yeah. And one guy said, if anybody had seen me perform in Fiddler on the Roof, in our school production of Fiddler on the Roof, they'd know that no one would pay me to act. He's 17.
There you go.
So anyway, we move on, though, to wokeness.
Yeah. It's something that I've been thinking about.
that had so much guilt in it.
I mean, it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently, and it's kind of come back in my consciousness because I watched Black Panther, and I loved it. And of course, I've been reading the think pieces on it since. And you've got a lot of really celebratory pieces, you know, people who are just in love with what this says about a pan-African story, about an African-American story, about representation in cinema. But you've also got this sort of subset of Black American academics, by and large, who are reading it with a very African-American lens and seeing certain elements in it that we otherwise may not, such as the breakup of the nuclear family and how a Black family can never stay united on screen, elements like that. And it got me thinking about something I've been thinking about a lot, which is how woke do we all have to be?
Where it reaches an acceptable level?
Yes. And is that acceptable level, does such a standard exist?
Right.
Or
but
are we all going to only be woke to, you know, the standard level of Americans, by and large?
But first of all, but perhaps you can just describe, what do you mean by woke, and we can all agree upon that?
Yeah, I was worried you were going to ask that, simply because I've been trying to wrap my head. When I first heard an intern use the term, I was very excited because I liked the connotations to it. Initially, I thought of things like being self-aware, being, I guess, conscious of their own place in society and their environment and how they're impacting it. I think that was what my understanding of it. Is there any more hip element to it that I'm missing out on?
I don't think it's hip so much as what you're saying is very self-focused.
Right.
Whereas to say that you're woke is to say that you're woke to a societal issue. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you're woke to your own reactions about the societal issue. It's more that now that you've seen fundamental inequalities,
what do you do about it?
You cannot be unwoke. That's the premise of being awake. You are awakened to it, and now you cannot go back to sleep because you know.
And I think it also implies that awareness of wider, larger landscapes and issues beyond your own little tiny little world.
And it's worth pointing out that it also has, you know, Black American origins. It kind of stemmed from that community. It didn't come from, you know, academia as such. it stemmed from people being able to say, I'm woke to something, or you're woke to something. Mm. And now it's passed, obviously, into common parlance. We're using it here in Malaysia. And I really do wonder. I mean, when we talk about being woke, whose standard are we awakening to? I mean, you know, do we have different levels?
Yeah, and you mentioned a Western liberal idea of wokeness, and I'm trying to
That's
think.
That's all there is, because there's no fascist wokeness, is there?
Well, one would think that there wouldn't be, but is there an Eastern Asian equivalent to it that is a little bit more customized to the needs of our society? I don't know.
I don't know if it's about needs. I mean, it's something that I was thinking about also, because when I was hanging out with a group of people from the Philippines, realizing that there's irreverent humor and then there's irreverent Filipino humor, and that is on kind of another separate level. And it's something that you also hear someone like, just to have a Pacific Islander kind of connection, it's something that you hear someone like Taika Waititi, who is the director of Thor Ragnarok and also various other excellent films. It's something he talks about, the New Zealand sense of humor, that irreverence and how it's central to it. And I think that when you talk about the American idea, and I use American because I think that's where the word is being used right. most, and that's where these thoughts are coming from. I feel that irreverence is not accounted for. You know, there is a notion that if you're not kind of hewing to this exact sort of vocabulary of what is okay, that you are not okay. Well, and I wonder if that's true.
Well, let's just take one example. Let's say LGBTQ...
IA.
Is there more letters? See, just by saying, are there more letters, I've lost my woke credentials.
Then this is true.
But
this is
I
true.
For intersex, A for asexual. So okay. That's what that...
All right. Yeah. Well, welcome to the party, folks.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that the idea is that we are all moving towards an understanding, acceptance is the right word? But anyway.
A wider inclusivity?
Inclusivity, where we don't even see differences. and we are all on that path, and we will all reach there together.
Right.
And that's wokeness.
And yet, of course, there are some people who want to embrace the differences, where inclusivity doesn't necessarily mean... No, I'm just saying that when you said we don't see the differences anymore, see, that's what I mean about these different standards. For some people, that might be considered, you know, the paragon of what we're all aiming for. And for others, they're like, no, you know what? I am different. That difference makes me special. I'm okay with that. I would rather you note my difference and my specialness as opposed to just homogenize me into, you know, this sort of like gray landscape of straightness.
Then we find those people, we denounce them, we stone them.
And that's what Twitter is for, really.
Yeah, fundamentally.
Right.
Now with more characters, even easier.
Yeah, and that's such a strange thing, because it feels, especially like on a forum like Twitter, it is an expression of wokeness that happens in that forum. It's so easy to be supported, but it's so easy to be vilified as well for your lack of understanding or even an entry into an understanding of a particular topic that you may or may not be familiar with.
I think that's kind of at the heart of it. I don't know whether the term woke, as it's currently being used and thrown around and, you know, used as a blanket statement, whether that can accommodate nuance. And I think that's missing in a lot of conversations.
So wokeness might be just another way of saying Western cultural hegemony.
Yes, hegemony of political correctness. Yeah. So it's kind of...
So now we're all like anti-colonialism. It's not like, you know, it's like let's go conquer lands. But well, it's and let's be embracing of gender difference, but by the standards of someone in San Francisco.
Well, you know, let me end on this very fascinating. I remember the moment when I figured out where the rabbit came from when the magician pulled it out of a hat at a birthday party.
Where?
There's a trick to it. I mean, but in that moment, I felt woke. just saying.
So there you have it, folks. Ezra's...
powerful anecdote. Yeah,
you know, homespun.
I bring it to the level where we all need it to be. An acceptable level.
A Disney character level. And... In a moment, though, we move on to, I think, one of the most pressing and important questions that we've ever asked on A Bit of Culture. What does a football manager do here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9? And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Ezra Zaid, and Lee Chui Lin. And now, topic number three, this is genuinely something I think about so much, which is the role of the football manager.
Right. So I'm glad you think about it a lot, Cam. Lin, it's safe to say that one of the more difficult existential questions that you've had to sort of deal with.
Grapple with, yeah.
Absolutely. What does a football manager do? Now, you know, it's so fascinating because it has so many layers to whether it's exclusive to a particular type of country, whether it's exclusive to matters on the sporting arena, off the sporting arena. It deals with issues of finance and power and structure, and trying to sort of encompass the idea as to what are the tenets of leadership that come with being a football manager. It is so difficult and complex, and just seeing the rate of football managers being dismissed and then hired again and then dismissed again, it is fascinating that if you were to go to a school, say, hey, I'd like to figure out a way to be a football manager, the curriculum would be actually quite extensive and complex to deal with. And so I'm trying to think of some of the more successful managers and what are the key ingredients that have made them stay in that profession successfully for so long versus a new generation of leaders who are adapting to new cultural norms, are adapting to new financial norms. What does that entail exactly? Mm. And I think it's changing so rapidly in this sporting world. So just even seeing the Super Bowl recently about how in the American system, the head coach is the head coach, but there's an offensive coach, there's a defensive coach, and these are not even the guys who are dealing with the contracts and the money.
And they're not even the guy who chooses the players.
That's right.
Another fellow chooses the players.
Yeah.
Well, speaking as a professional footballer myself,
of course,
speaking to another two, Lynn, I know you went to a very high level as a footballer. So,
thank you. Right. Thank you for remembering.
But outside looking in, there are cultural differences. I think that British, English football manager holds a different place than an Italian or a Spanish. I think I read somewhere that Britain, it's all about the manager. In Spain, it's about the player. And in Italy, it's about the team. That's the kind of the focus that the team or the club, for that matter. So that's kind of how the audience interprets the game as it's unfolding. They're looking at these different elements, whereas we've probably grown up watching the English game. It's always about what's that old man on the side going to do to rectify the behavior of these children on the pitch.
In a constricted time frame where emotions are running high, and when it's not game day, it's ego management of the highest order.
Well, you know, the thing that strikes me about all of it is also, it feels as if the managers that we all remember are the ones with a cult of personality.
Mm.
And that's interesting as well, because on the one hand, as you pointed out, you have to be the savviest of businessmen. You have to be most likely not a very good football player in your time, but now an excellent football strategist for some reason. And you also have to be an accountant, or at least talk to accountants a lot. But you also somehow, through all of this boring stuff, also have to be someone where people fear you, or people think you're a genius, or people think you're, you know, the ones that we remember, the ones that fans of particular football teams trot out time and time again, are, I mean, of course they're the ones who win,
yeah,
but they're also the ones who somehow become sort of demigods. I mean, mm, you have to kind of achieve that level.
They're immortalized for something that they transmitted to a group of 11 players that went beyond trophies, right? That, oh, I remember that team led by that manager because it imbued a particular type of philosophy.
Spirit.
And spirit, yeah, right? And so,
yeah. I want to get in here. So, very, very, very excited. So, Ezra Zide, you're a glory hunter. You're a fan of Manchester United.
That's right.
And so obviously, Sir Alex Ferguson.
Right. I thought Ezra would be the first one to say his name.
Well, I want to get there first. I want to denounce
that's
that.
That's called restraint.
It was pretty good. It was powerful.
So one of the things with Ferguson is, though, that he was very particular in the course of the players that he chose.
Right.
Because he wanted to create an environment where the players had a certain kind of personality. They did not have overweening personalities that were like a me, me, me. They didn't overshadow the club. They couldn't therefore question him.
Right.
Until they did, and then they got a scar over the eyebrow.
That's right. And then David Beckham gets kicked out because he's become too much of a celeb. The ideal player for Alex Ferguson's way of seeing things would be a Paul Scholes.
Or a Mikhail Silvest.
But the interesting thing is, and I agree with that premise a great deal, but what I'm fascinated about moments of leadership is seeing how a manager like Ferguson then adapts to what happens when somebody like a Cantona comes in, where the rules are bent, when a Cristiano Ronaldo comes in and you make difficult decisions to remove the more senior players to accommodate the potential of what this person can be in the next 3-4 years and building things around it. So making those judgments and having the flexibility and the longevity of what somebody wants to do.
Let's have a look at the judgment that he made with, say, Eric Cantona. A lot of the other players were complaining after a while amongst themselves. They didn't dare say it to Ferguson. Mm. Was how come he shouts at us, but he never says a word against Eric Cantona? He never questioned. He said, you, Paul Scholes, or whatever, you're doing a terrible job. Right. Eric, you're doing great. Well done. Keep it up.
Yeah.
And he just knew that Eric Cantona was a fella who just didn't need to be shouted at.
Right.
I guess we come back to the man management aspect of it. But I also wonder now that since Alex Ferguson's been brought up, there was an age difference, or at least in the era that I was growing up in and starting to watch football.
Between manager and player.
And
yeah.
That age difference is now narrowing significantly. And I think that's also really interesting because you used to have all these guys basically performing for their surrogate dad. I mean, that's if you look at the kinds of things that people used to say about managers, it would be, I just wanted to make him proud. And now it's more like, well, how, you know, it's like making your stepbrother proud or something. There's not that same sort of respect gap that comes from seniority, that comes from age.
And also, I guess, you know, you hear phrases like, oh, he's almost like a second father. And you're right. The dynamics of a family within the dressing room and within the pitch, you know, I almost stumble at family gatherings myself, trying to sort of make sure that everybody's having a good time and everybody's, you know, laughing and eating in all the right places. But to do so in professional circumstances where your job is on the line, it's unforgiving.
Interesting to say that about the younger manager, Lynn, because my favorite manager and the manager I read books about, I watch TV shows about, is Brian Clough. Absolute enigma, really. What was his genius? I mean, he took this provincial club, Nottingham Forest, a nothing club, took them up a league, and then he had them win the European Championship twice.
And then several thousand movies were made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that he had, because he was pretty much only a little bit older than his players. Mm. His playing career had been cut short by an injury, so he had to move into management. And he had different ways of dealing with different players. So some players he would heap with praise. He did that a lot. And some players, like Martin O'Neill, who played very well for him, he never said a nice word to him. But he still got the best out of them. He just realized that some you kick, some you don't.
It feels that a lot of these traits that you're talking about, I feel that they're translatable to other environments, especially in an office, for example, or when you're thinking of building teams and wanting to make them perform. And how do you encourage someone? Do you use a carrot? Do you use a stick? And it's my own personal reference of what does effective leadership look like?
And I think you're wrong, Ezra Zayed. I don't know if you can carry these things over, because a football manager is usually 100% of the time a man, and his wards are young men.
Yeah, this
so,
is true.
So, you know, if you have...
It's a different kind of space, isn't it?
Yeah. In an office, you're going to have women and older women and young, old, whatever.
With different roles, not performing the same
function.
Yes. Yeah.
Although I do also just want to interject one last thought, which is that I find it interesting that you expect football managers to do the same in every club as if they're a true believer, even when they can't possibly be.
Yeah.
Because that to me is fascinating. Because sometimes you get this manager and the club, and it's a perfect match. And you look at them and you go, well, you're an attacking team, you're an attacking manager. You're both sort of willing to, you know, win games by like 10-5. So great, you know, go forth, go entertain me. But then that manager might win and then leave, and then suddenly you're...
Do something special with another club.
Exactly, or not. To see that translation of that manager to another club where he cannot possibly believe, you know, in the ethos of the club, but now he's hired by them and now he's just an employee. That's fascinating to me.
Well, before we finish this then, perhaps we could all just nominate a manager that we find of interest at the moment. Anybody around?
At the moment?
Yeah. What does that mean?
I don't know.
I mean, living and breathing right now, I'll go with Jurgen Klopp, a German who is now the manager at Liverpool.
Right.
I find him fascinating. What he is doing there is the most Clough-like manager.
Right.
And he's German. I'm really always interested to see how he copes, as opposed to, say, the kind of the dying car crash that is Jose Mourinho.
This is unfortunately slightly true.
No, that's fair. I don't have a favorite or somebody that I find particularly fascinating at the moment. But just for the sake of devil's advocate-ness, I think Pep Guardiola and his temper is really interesting.
His relationship with his temper?
Yes. Yeah. I find his relationship with his temper and his emotions really fascinating because, again, it's a social media world, and now if you have, you know, if you
have an emotion and it's captured on screen.
Exactly. You're a meme forever. Yeah. And Pep Guardiola, I think, is very memeable.
I think one of the reasons why he's successful, and also Jurgen Klopp, is that he offers to his players on an individual level, he'll say, I can improve you as a player.
Right. But again, that comes down to that level of emotional investment, right? And then the kind of emotional disappointment you get when someone doesn't live up to it, it's fascinating. I just love seeing that little fiery thing.
Well, in terms of living and breathing, and although he's not in business right now.
Oh, boy.
it's still got to be Ferguson for me, only because...
Heavenly choirs sing.
Yes. Because I think in his absence, he's gotten better and better. Yeah. Like, the legacy of Ferguson was great when he retired, but it's just gotten better and better as Manchester United don't win the league or don't win the Champions League. It feels like the things that he achieved towards the end of his career are almost sort of mind-boggling.
I agree, but I think it's really disrespectful that you ignored all of Cam's caveats to avoid using Sir Alex Ferguson.
I control my own microphone.
Yeah. So Ezra Zide, you're a young man now, but then you're like, you know, much older and you're still going, oh, Sir Alex Ferguson, those were the days. That's going to be what we call sad.
I've come to terms with that.
Okay, good. So now we come, though, to the final part of the show. By the way, I really enjoyed that. I've been wanting to do that for, like, forever.
You're welcome.
that was pretty much the conversation that goes on in my head all the time. So we come to the final part of the show, recommendation. Recommend something of interest, and I go first, don't I? My recommendation is I'd like to recommend that you look up a woman called Sophie Scholl.
How do you spell Scholl?
S-C-H-O-L-L. There might even be an umlaut in there, so it could be Schul. And she was German, died at the age of 21, so we're talking about young people earlier. And she and her brother, they started up a resistance movement in Germany at the height of the war, anti-Nazi movement, and she and her brother tried to distribute leaflets in 1943, I think, and they got captured and interrogated and tortured and then executed. The Germans are very meticulous people, so they documented the entire interrogation.
As they do.
And so the legacy of humanity and her desire for resistance lives on. It was ultimately an utterly futile act. Nobody, I think, even saw her leaflets. And I'm fascinated by her because I always wonder, would I have done that?
Yeah, I was going to say that's the theme of what you've brought to the table today, right? Like this would I have been able to do that at 21 or at 17? Would I be that person?
And I think this personal reflection is terrific, at least on Cam's part.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm sure it was patronizing, but I'm woke enough to take that.
Do you have an answer for yourself, Cam?
Because I have often, you know, come to moments where I think I don't want to be too far ahead in the future, say, oh, I wish I had done that. And so I sort of compress that question about maybe I need to participate in this action or this moment now.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's an ongoing
debate,
and you react as and when. But anyway, so Sophie Scholl, a brave young woman, and I'd like you to go check her out.
All right.
So, Lynn.
Okay, I'm hoping no one said this yet because I thought it was amazing. So I've been meaning to recommend this. It's an article in the New York Times. It's called Deliverance from 27,000 Feet. Did either of you read that?
No. I've got it bookmarked, but...
Not me.
I really do believe that you and most human beings would really enjoy it. I mean, it's incredibly sad. It's incredibly affecting. It's basically the story of a doomed Everest expedition with three people who died, one of whom can't be found, two of whom they know exactly where on the trek they are.
Right.
And the effort it takes to deliver their bodies from Everest, from almost the peak of Everest, back down to their villages in India. And India? It's either India or Nepal. I'm forgetting
now. So they were Sherpas then?
They were not Sherpas.
Oh.
That's the thing.
That's the point.
No, but that's the other thing about the article. it never once occurred to me that it wasn't only wealthy Swiss people who scaled Everest, you know, that there were people who grew up in its shadow. There are people who see it. There are people who dream of it. And there are people who saved for like decades to get all the gear to be able to go up, and how they might not be willing to give up even though their time has just passed. You know, the window of opportunity to see the peak has passed, and they refuse to accept that and they keep going. And one of them is a one-armed tailor who sewed his own snowsuit. I mean, it's an incredible piece of reporting. And it comes with videos of the Sherpas who went to obtain the corpses frozen solid of these men and to kind of rappel it down, to slide it down, helicopter, funeral. It takes you from the beginning of their journey till the end. It covers, I think, almost 2 years, because they have to wait for the season on Everest to reopen in order to do it. Then they have to wait for it to almost end because they don't want to interrupt the climbers who are going up.
It's an entire odyssey.
It is. And the reporting on it is cinematic and amazing and beautiful. It's multimedia. It's really rich. It's well written. I just wish more people would read it. It's a long article, and maybe it gets lost in the shuffle. But if I could recommend one thing, which I can, that would be it. Deliverance from 27,000 feet. It's on the New York Times.
Wow. Okay.
Well, from German Nazis to bringing dead bodies
down Everest.
Down Everest.
To the roof of the world. What the hell have you got?
I've got a recommendation for a television series.
Which is great.
It's a reality TV show, and it can be seen on Netflix. It's called Terrace House. Now, the premise is simple. Six people, young people, live in a house. Three guys, three girls. There is no script.
There is a car.
What the entire show does is, there are no challenges. There are no
eliminations.
It's basically just living together and them proceeding with their daily lives. But a lot of the confrontation or management of conflicts or opportunities to find love in this house occur because they're living in a shared space. With most reality TV series, think Big Brother, think The Apprentice, the provocation to poke somebody happens because of, you know, something that the producer put in place.
Or just because there's money at the end of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, it is just day-to-day life. And to see how, I guess, Japanese folks navigate
It's a Japanese show.
Yes.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Which is the best part.
Okay. Which is the best part is that to see how all of these different characters respond to one another. And I've always wanted to sort of understand Japanese culture, the Japanese psyche. And, you know, reading Murakami has helped in some shape, way or form. But I feel that this reality TV show has really just blasted the doors for me. And I've been so satisfied with every episode that I watch, because the format also happens that it cuts away to a panel of commentators. There are six commentators who then essentially reflect your own thoughts as a viewer, and you start cheering the commentators on because you feel validated as a viewer that, oh, that's what I thought of that particular participant as well. And so there's this wonderful meta thing going on, but an observation of your own self, that maybe that's how I behaved 5 years ago, maybe that's who I dated 3 months ago. It's all of these different nuggets of social behavior that has just pretty much blown my mind, and I've shared it with Lynn.
This is probably the biggest single change Ezra Zayed has brought into my life for the positive. So I wholeheartedly endorse this recommendation.
When you were describing it, I was thinking, God, that sounds really boring. But then you said it was Japanese.
That's,
I thought,
it's so good.
That makes it interesting.
The kinds of conflict that go on are, will you wash the dishes? I will. And you're like, whoa, it's amazing.
But the key part of it is, and seeing how they all interact, things really pop out that may not exist in our society. So for these 20-something-year-olds, there's a lot of discussion about, what is your purpose and ambition? What are you doing in 3 months? What are you doing at the end of the year? What are you doing to achieve something? And I never had those conversations in that sort of setting, or at least, I guess, it's television. It's compressed in such a way. But just to see how, you know, we praise the Japanese for a wide variety of things, you know. And I think just to see how it interacts and how it's all compressed in this space, it's really fascinating. Terrace House, it can be seen on Netflix. That's like 2-3 seasons there. It's
just binge it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. I think I probably will, actually. So that brings us neatly to the end of this week's show. And only remains for me now to request, folks, that you like our Facebook page. Did I say that right, Lynn?
You did okay.
Yeah. On MySpace and poke us with your Vine.
Wow.
Well, I think Vine has shut down.
It has. It's right. Gone.
But
it's
no,
gone.
It's good that Cam's got it, though. He's got it on hold.
Okay.
It's an important part of the internet.
Thank you. And for me to thank special honored guest, Lee Treelin.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ezra Zayed.
Arigato.
On our show, all too rarely. In fact, on radio in general, far too rarely. And myself, Cam Ruslan. And so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.